This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, or wherever you listen, and rate and review us whenever you listen to us. Today, I'm talking with Damon Root. He's a senior editor at Reason. He's the author of Overruled, a great book about the Supreme Court, and we are talking about Anthony Kennedy, an associate justice deciding to retire after being on the high court since 1987. What are Kennedy's main legacies, and what the hell is going to happen now that he is taking his final ride into the sunset? Damon, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's start out by sketching the vast legacy of Kennedy. You and other people have written about how he may not be as flashy as somebody like Antonin Scalia. He wasn't the Chief Justice. He wasn't as controversial as somebody like Clarence Thomas or even Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But you believe that he is like one of the major, major influences on the court in the past 50 years. Why was that?
Well, due to just sort of the chance of the way the court is made up and has been for a little while, where you have, kind of a four justice liberal block and a four justice conservative block, and Kennedy, who is the sort of moderate conservative with liberal tendencies, or maybe you want to, flip that around the other way. He's sort of right there in the middle. So he is this tie-breaking fifth vote in so many cases. And I think if you take the broad view of the biggest questions in American law over the last three decades, his fingerprints are just all over the answers that the court has come up with. So from abortion, gay rights, gay marriage, to campaign finance control, he wrote Citizens United. He was the when the four conservatives dissented in the Obamacare case in 2012, they filed a joint dissent. Kennedy's the one who read it from the bench, it was clear that he thought Obamacare should have been struck down in its entirety, which he emphasized. So it's, you can just sort of name the issue, affirmative action, go on and on.
Yeah.
And he's sort of right there at the center of it. And so the influence, so every lawyer who was approaching the bench, that they were going to make at least one part of their argument was pitched sort of directly to him. So whether you sort of liked his jurisprudence or not, and I think everybody disliked it at some point, and we can get into that sort of some of the, maybe the inconsistencies in it, you just couldn't deny the influence. And so he's probably done more than anyone to shape the course of American law over the last 30 years.
Now, but that's not necessarily because he has a, particularly influential theory of the law, along the lines of, say, somebody like a Robert Bork had a kind of unified field theory, or Scalia claimed to, and Clarence Thomas probably does. It's more that he's the right guy in the right place. He was the swing vote.
There's definitely something to that. I mean, Kennedy had theories of the law in certain areas that I think you can identify. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is the author of all four of the Supreme Court's big decisions affirming gay rights, from Romer v. Evans through Lawrence v. Texas all the way up to the recognition of gay marriage as a constitutional right. So he is the architect. I mean, obviously lawyers craft the arguments and bring it before the court, but I mean, he is the author, he's the architect of that. And there's a coherence to the ideas he was putting forward there. Those cases all hang together.
Let's focus on that a little bit. What was that theory? Was it that, the state doesn't have the right to discriminate against two individuals? Is it that it's nobody's business? Is it related to privacy rights? Obviously, a lot of people, and I guess abortion rights kind of are, fall under, to some degree, privacy rights because of the way that they were first articulated on the Supreme Court. And everybody's saying now that, Kennedy's gone, kiss Roe v. Wade goodbye. But what was his theory that said, the state shouldn't discriminate against two people who want to get married just because they're the same gender?
Well, this was an area of the law where he had a broad conception of the word liberty. And so he would look at the word liberty in the due process clause, which says that, that the government, there's a due process clause in the Fifth Amendment and in the 14th Amendment. So the government at both levels cannot deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process. And he imbued a lot of meaning into that word liberty. And so the sphere of liberty included the rights of sexual autonomy, of mm-hmm. sexual privacy, of intimate relations within the home. So if you go back to maybe his most important decision in all of those cases, I think the gay marriage ruling gets that's sort of the capstone on it. But mm-hmm. Lawrence versus Texas in 2003, that overturns the Supreme Court case from the 80s called Bowers versus Hardwick. And what Bowers said was that that state governments have every lawful right under their police powers to prohibit intimate same-sex relations, can reach into the bedroom and say that two consenting adults of the same sex cannot have a romantic relationship, sexual relationship. And Lawrence versus Texas strikes that down and says that is an overreach on the part of the state, that is a sphere of liberty that the Constitution should protect, in his view does protect. And so I think that's maybe the centerpiece of all of it, and the different cases kind of radiate out from that idea. Now, obviously, a lot of legal conservatives had a problem with that. They thought that that's judicial activism. That's an unenumerated right. Where does the Constitution say anything about gay marriage, let alone privacy, which is also a right that's not mentioned in the Constitution.
But then again, where does it say that the state has the right? The mind boggles because these cases go back to, the 80s, and it seems like, geez, why were we even talking about this stuff? How, we've moved on from it, but...
I was just saying, as you mentioned, the foundational abortion rights case, Roe versus Wade, and then right a few years before that, a case called Griswold versus Connecticut. Those are rooted in the right to privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So because Griswold starts with the Connecticut had a law in the books that said married couples cannot obtain or use birth control devices. And that was struck down as infringing a right to privacy. And then the right to abortion is rooted in that.
Right.
And so this goes back to those cases really. And so people like Robert Bork and Justice Scalia, who absolutely believe those cases were wrong and should not have been decided that way. They believe the state has this authority. Mm-hmm. And, where does the Constitution say there's a right to privacy? And this is something that is still very much, debated on the legal right. The court has settled the question, I think, for some, it's been settled in the court. But I mean, legal conservatives are still, at odds with each other over this. And one of the interesting things about about Senator Rand Paul is he has been kind of at the forefront among political conservatives of saying, yes, the Constitution does protect a right to privacy. And he's kind of thrown a gauntlet down in terms of where the public debate is about this. And so that's something that it's coming up in these judicial confirmations.
Although Rand Paul is also, I mean, he believes in a right to privacy, but he is also super anti-abortion. So he would either say, when we're talking about privacy, we're talking about police surveillance, but we're not talking about the right, a sphere of privacy that allows women to abort, fetuses.
What he has said is that Griswold is correctly decided, but not Roe v. Wade. So he draws a distinction there based on, because there's also the word life, liberty, or property. And so abortion takes life. That's how he threads the needle there. But in terms of a foundational argument, where you come down on a case like Griswold, if you're a judicial thinker, that matters a lot. A lot of things, and Rand Paul has threaded an interesting needle between a libertarian and a conservative position, I think you could say, on that. They're settled in the courts sort of broadly, and certainly in law schools and places like that. But there's an appetite among some legal conservatives to get back at those precedents and dial them back or overturn them or something.
How you were talking about the right to privacy, and certainly I think most libertarians like the idea of certainly that married couples and actually single people should be able to get birth control and also the right to abortion as well as a number of other privacy rights. Is Kennedy, and he was often talked about, and this is partly related to his free speech stances, was he the most libertarian, consistently libertarian justice during his tenure on the court?
Well, he gave a statement about that once where he said, some people, have described me as a libertarian, but I don't know what that means. I think most libertarians probably would agree with him that he didn't know what it means because in 2005, there were these two cases that were explicitly libertarian, brought by libertarian lawyers that come before the Supreme Court. Kelo versus City of New London, the eminent domain case, brought by the Institute for Justice, and then Gonzalez v. Raich, the medical marijuana case argued by libertarian law professor Randy Barnett. And Kennedy joins the majority opinion of Justice John Paul Stevens, a very much a non-libertarian justice,
right,
in both of those cases. So libertarians have really been kind of shaking their fists at Kennedy.
And Stevens emerged. I mean, he was appointed by Nixon, I think, but he emerged as a leading liberal on the court.
Yeah, he's a Republican appointee, but is the liberal leader
right,
the final last sort of 20 years of his career.
Yeah.
Absolutely goes out.
And
as
so
the,
what
kind of
was
leader of the liberal bloc.
What was Kennedy? I mean, you know, so the Kelo case is, you know, and I think a lot of our listeners already know, you know, but it's about what libertarians were calling it eminent domain abuse, because it was the taking of private property that was being directly given essentially to a private contractor. And then the theory behind that was that as long as the city said it would raise the overall tax base of their jurisdiction, yeah, it was fine. It was a public use. Is that what Kennedy signed on to in that?
He signed on to that in full. He did write a concurrence where he sort of speculated, well, maybe there could be, you know, examples where we wouldn't do something like this. But maybe we would look to if there was a nefarious purpose, if there was some kind of, you know, cronyism going on behind the scenes. But, you know, it wasn't this case.
Hmm.
The Fifth Amendment says, the private property shall not be taken for public use without payment of just compensation. So the
right.
key words in Kelo were public use. Is this a public use? But
right.
what the Supreme Court had held in a couple earlier cases was, well, it doesn't actually have to be a public use. It just has to be a public purpose, which is a much more lenient standard. And then and Connecticut, London's argument was that we're basically raising the tax base, you know,
yep.
having this huge development that benefits the Pfizer Corporation, which is building this new research center in New London. You know, that's going to raise the tax base. That's a public purpose. And under that lenient standard, the eminent domain use kind of sails through. And so Kennedy joined that. And Kennedy I talked to Scott Bullock. I interviewed him for my book. He's the lawyer who argued the case before the court. And he expected Kennedy to be more friendly to them because Kennedy had written opinions that were strongly pro property rights. And so he was, he said it was very frustrating doing the oral argument because Kennedy just wasn't biting. And then sure enough, he joins the majority.
And
there.
Then talk about.
Oh, I was just going to pivot to, you know, so that's the sort of the ways that he's been a big problem for libertarians. But I think also it has to be said, if you look at the bigger picture of his jurisprudence, he has been the one justice on the court who has maintained your basic libertarian mix of being socially conservative and, you know, economically
right.
conservative or whatever, you know, the standards that
that
people use.
But is that kind of. I don't know. Is that like results based as opposed to kind of theoretical? Because let's talk about the Raich case where this was about medical marijuana and whether or not the government's commerce clause, you know, the federal government's commerce clause allowed the government to dictate what was going on within a state in terms of a completely internal medical marijuana market. And they went back to an old case from the Depression where, the ruling against it was the idea that even if you are, you know, you're not involved in interstate commerce because this is an illegal substance, and even on the black market, if you're growing your own weed in your backyard under California law, which would have been legal to help with whatever disease you had, and you're certified by the state of California as somebody who's legitimately in need of medical marijuana, the idea was that by growing that plant in your backyard rather than buying it from a drug dealer who might have interstate connections, you know, so you're the Congress actually can crack down on that because somehow or another indirectly you're interfering with or you're affecting interstate commerce. And Kennedy went on that. I mean, that doesn't seem very economically liberal. That seems, it's certainly not socially liberal. But what did he give a particular indication of where his thought was on that case?
Well, I think that for him it was that federal drug control scheme, federal drug control policy, the Controlled Substances Act, which was the law at issue here, was a proper exercise of federal power. I think he saw it that way. Maybe there was just he was less sympathetic to the drug markets or something like that. I mean, I would say that this gets at I think one of the big things about his jurisprudence in total is that it even people who liked parts of it would get really frustrated with him in other ways because there didn't always seem to be a consistency from case to case, And so we're talking about sort of some of the libertarian frustrations with him, but the conservatives had this, liberals had this, because he could be very good from a particular point of view in one case and then seem to be at the other end of the issue in others. And that was, and that's something that, that just kind of is a hallmark of his jurisprudence, is that he would delight and disappoint, you know, everybody over the course of all these
so
years.
So he is a libertarian because everybody hates half of what he believes at any given point in time.
Well, there's something to that. I mean, if you look at there's all these individual cases where there's, you know, libertarians are not happy about it. But then in terms of some big picture results, you know, I mean, this is the one justice who is in favor of both gay rights and gun rights. And that's something that's maybe unique to libertarians in the,
modern kind of world.
And so that you can say that about.
You know, a couple things that I want to talk about are, you know, gun rights, the Obamacare decisions that he was involved in, and then also Citizens United. But talk about gun rights. How instrumental was he in, you know, the Supreme Court ultimately recognizing a constitutional right to own and bear arms?
Well, it's those are 5-4 cases. So he's number five. Alan Gura, the lawyer who argued both Heller and McDonald versus Chicago, told me that during the Heller oral arguments, when Kennedy piped in basically on their side, when the Washington D.C. was arguing that this is basically, it's not an individual right. This is it's a collective right tied to it's basically the Second Amendment is there as a states' rights provision, not as an individual rights provision. And Kennedy piped in with something effective. You mean that, you know, the people on the frontier, you know, that it wasn't understood that they had a right to have a rifle to, you know, protect them from, I think he said grizzly bears or something, which wouldn't even make sense. That's that would be out west, you know, not in.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was sort of getting at the point that certainly that Gura and his fellow lawyers were making, which is that this is understood as an individual right. There's a right to self-defense, to certainly have these weapons in the home for self-defense. And he sort of piped right in. And, where he was going to come down on that was people had guesses, but they didn't know. And so once he did that, that was, I think they saw that as real wind under their sails in terms of the where the oral argument was going. I'm sure that the lawyers for the District of Columbia were not at all happy to sort of receive that. He doesn't write his own opinions of that. He joins Scalia's opinion in Heller, and then he joins Alito's opinion in McDonald.
What about what about when it comes to Obamacare? Because this was, you know, in a lot of ways, the Obamacare case, which, you know, is rooted in other recent cases and just kind of all sorts of stuff about compelling people and whether or not something is, you know, is a tax or an activity or whatever. How do you kind of assess Kennedy's role in the big Obamacare cases?
Well, that's the case where he's absolutely with the libertarians on the Commerce Clause argument, because that was one of the issues in that case was that. Does Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, is that compelled? Is that broad enough to allow the government to compel activity or to regulate inactivity? That was the argument. And Kennedy, Scalia, Alito, and Thomas say no, absolutely not. And actually, Roberts says no to that too. Then he writes the opinion that says, well, we won't look at it. It's true that this would be an excess of the Commerce Clause, but since there's another way, if we can find a way to save the law by viewing it as an exercise of the tax power, then our duty under theories of judicial deference obligate us to do that. So then we will save it. So actually, there were 5 votes for the Commerce Clause position, when you count it. So Kennedy was, you know, so whereas what, and, you know, Scalia, just to bring him into it, he had also joined Gonzales v. Rache, that Commerce Clause medical marijuana case was 6-3. And Scalia also, and that was something that was very surprising to people at the time. And I think that Scalia essentially kind of repudiates that view. He doesn't say so publicly, but he basically repudiates it as part of the Obamacare case.
Right. Not to get dragged off into a discussion of Scalia, but it seemed like his decision in Raich was almost completely results oriented rather than coming out of a philosophical bent, because it seems out of context with, you know, a general interest in limiting the reach and the power of the government and the expansion of the Interstate Commerce Clause.
Well, I wouldn't say that Scalia was necessarily interested in limiting the reach and power of the government. I mean, he he thought the original meaning of the Constitution, which I think he did always practice, but that was what he said. In some instances, his view of the original meaning of the Constitution gave the government a lot of power, whether it's state government or the federal government, in terms of, say, foreign powers or something like that. So Scalia was not coming at it from a kind of a libertarian first principle.
Right.
Sometimes his views aligned with them, but then other times they didn't. And then Kennedy, the question with him is a sort of what were some of the legal principles he was operating under. And I think you could identify them, you know, in some cases, but not quite across the board in the way that, you know, you're able to with other justices. And, you know, maybe Supreme Court that's bitterly divided, maybe there's something to be said for having this guy kind of in the middle. So it's, you know, there's a little surprise in terms of the outcome, you know, in a country that's very politically divided, you know, that I think a lot of people might miss Kennedy. Libertarians might miss him too, even though, you know, libertarians shook their fists at him, because his replacement could be someone who's much more socially conservative and takes the court in directions that libertarians also. But that, you know, that's all kind of the questions for tomorrow, as we'll see who the nominee is.
So what about free speech? Talk about, or more specifically, talk about Citizens United and his role, because, you know, those of us who remember when Citizens United was decided, that was the end of the empire. It was like the scene in Star Wars when, you know, the chancellor becomes the emperor of, you know, of the dark side of the universe. Where was Kennedy on all that?
Kennedy is the author of the Citizens United opinion. So every, you know, every progressive who's tearing their hair out, you know, over that then and still today, you know, he's to blame for that. That's his ruling.
Yep.
And it's, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's taking on this sort of a Roe v. Wade kind of power on the left. It's a, it's a rallying cry against the direction that, you know, that they, people don't want the court to go and so forth. And, yeah, Kennedy was very pretty hawkish on the First Amendment overall. You know, he supported the First Amendment right to burn flags and you know, in sort of contentious cases like that. So that's an aspect of his jurisprudence that he was pretty consistent there.
Yeah.
And but because, you know, these cases, some of these First Amendment cases now, people on the left start to see them as, oh, well, that's a conservative use of the First Amendment, that conservatives weaponizing the First Amendment. You know, he doesn't get the sort of the credit on the left, maybe, that he
for being a
for
First
being
Amendment
consistent.
Guy. Yeah. What's the nut of the Citizens United decision? It's that people, individuals, don't lose their speech rights when they become affiliate as corporations, right? That political speech should be largely unregulated, right?
Well, I mean, there's still plenty of regulations on it.
Yeah.
You can get rid of all of them. But yeah, I mean, the case is about, you know, Hillary, the movie that this group,
yeah,
Citizens United, puts out before an election, and the campaign finance laws at the time said that, you know, that's a electioneering. And so that couldn't be released within, you know, a certain time period before, you know, a midterm and then general elections. And, you know, the argument is that, well, just because we formed into a nonprofit organization, you know, like, we don't forfeit the First Amendment.
Right.
You know, if a for-profit had made the same, you know, movie or a book. And that was the case where during the oral arguments, you know, the lawyer for the government sort of had to concede that under their theory of the case, you know, you could ban the publication of a book, like maybe a campaign biography or, you know, something like that. And so I know a lot of people on the left don't like the outcome of that, because they see it as just, you know, giving money to the, you know, letting the oligarchs pour more money into the elections or something like that. There were pretty significant First Amendment concerns in terms of, I mean, if the First Amendment protects anything, it would protect, you know, the ability to publish a book or a film. And just the fact that a nonprofit, which could be a union, a church, I mean, you know, like, the, you know, the word corporation is sort of thrown a lot, but these are all corporate entities, you know, engaging in speech. And so the idea that when people pool together or join together in that form, you know, they'd forfeit all rights. You know, one way to think about it is just, you know, does a corporation, a corporate entity, does it have, can the government just take its property, for eminent domain without paying just compensation,
right,
just because it's formed in that, you know, like, nobody would think that would be the case.
Where was he?
Some of those rights.
I'm thinking about, you know, the moments when certain individuals lose certain speech rights. So where was he on Bong Hits for Jesus, where it was ruled that a student attending an event that was not mandatory, it was not on school practices and whatnot, but he got in trouble for You know, when the school was allowed to discipline him for his Bong Hits for Jesus poster. Do you know where Kennedy was on that?
You know, I can't remember what the final vote was in that case. So I don't recall. I don't recall that one.
Okay. But we do know that if it was medical marijuana, he probably would have told the kid not to smoke it.
Yeah, that's right.
So let me ask you a couple of things here that have to do with process going forward. You write a lot about the shift and the meaningful, the kind of conflict between conservative visions of law, which are built around judicial restraint and deference to majorities, perhaps best kind of personified by Robert Bork's theory that, you know, basically a majority can do whatever it wants. As long as, it can pass laws to do whatever it wants, as long as they're duly elected and all of that kind of stuff. Your argument is that what's happened among libertarian legal theorists is that, no, you know what, the point of the court is not to be totally deferential to legislatures or majorities, but rather that the Constitution is, as Frederick Douglass and others have called it, a glorious liberty document, and that the Supreme Court should be more active in striking down laws that infringe on basic individual rights as understood, you know, at the founding and, you know, and in different ways since then. Where do you put Kennedy on that? Does he fit into that scheme in a neat and tidy way? Or is he kind of straddling both camps, or is he coming at it from a completely different angle?
I don't think anyone would accuse Kennedy of being a deferential judge. Mm-hmm. You know, he's involved in a number of cases where precedents are overturned, either that he either wrote or joined into. So I think that he had a vision of the courts that the libertarian legal view generally accorded with. He didn't necessarily come to it from some of the same philosophical reasons, but in terms of the idea that the courts are supposed to be a bulwark, mm-hmm. and protecting individual rights and the fact that a law is democratically passed is not sufficient.
Right.
And so a case like Lawrence versus Texas, mm-hmm. you know, Kennedy did something in his majority opinion in that case where the argument, and certainly what Scalia was pushing for in dissent, was like, listen, this is just not an area for judges. You know, if people want to change these, you know, if Texas is going to get rid of its Homosexual Conduct Act, which is what the law was called, then that should be the voters of Texas should do that. It should not be these unelected federal judges and so forth. And Kennedy kind of flipped the analysis and said, you know, that we don't start with this presumption of deference to the lawmakers here. We start with a presumption that, you know, that the individuals have rights, and then we're going to find out if the government is overstepped its bounds. And so put the burden of proof on the government rather than putting the burden of proof on the individual to prove that they have suffered a harm in the first place. And so in that sense,
that's pretty good.
Does line up. Yeah. So he lines up. So that's a decision that libertarian legal types like. They don't mm-hmm. necessarily agree with every little twist and turn he made in it, but that kind of broader stance, it's something that was celebrated at the time and is too. And I write about that a fair bit in one of the chapters in my book, because it's an important moment in the law, just in terms of it highlights debates. Some of the fissures among the conservative legal movement, you know, libertarian faction, conservative faction, so forth, were mm-hmm. really kind of brought to the forefront in that case. And you know, it's been more open conflict since.
What can you say about the circumstances under which he was both nominated and confirmed? Was it a particularly contentious time? I mean, when you go back to the 80s and the early 90s, I mean, I think the stuff people remember most are the Bork hearings and the Clarence Thomas hearings. How was Kennedy treated, and did he slip through easily? And is there anything that we might glean about, his replacement's confirmation hearing based on the circumstances of him getting onto the bench?
Well, Kennedy was Reagan's third choice. The first choice was Bork, who was borked, you know, that hearing.
It's really as with Lou Gehrig dying of Lou Gehrig's disease, it was very fortunate that Bork shared the name with the process that was used to destroy him.
Yeah, I know. Who could have seen it? Who could have seen it coming? Yeah. So there was Bork first.
Right.
The beginning in many ways of the modern kind of, you know, nuclear showdowns over judges. Yeah. After Bork is defeated, then it's and then Douglas Ginsburg's name is put forward, and he ends up dropping out of consideration when it comes out that he'd smoked marijuana. So then Kennedy is the third choice. Seen at the Republican, he's in the Bork mold, so it's much less of a controversial thing. The Senate Democrats led by Ted Kennedy and Joe Biden and people like that, really succeeded in defeating Bork, who rightfully saw in many ways as a kind of a Judicial conservative that was not going to be voting the way they wanted. And if you just think about the difference in terms of abortion laws, abortion cases with Bork on the court versus Kennedy, I mean, it really is. It was a very monumental difference there.
How would Bork have? Would Bork have ruled in abortion cases? I realize we're getting a little bit off topic here, but if legislatures in New York and California and whatnot decriminalized or legalized abortion, would Bork have been in a position where it'd be like, you got to go with the majority there?
No, he would have been fine with the states doing whatever they wanted on it. I think he would have. I don't think he would have hesitated in Planned Parenthood versus Casey to overrule Roe v. Wade, which is what almost happened there. And Kennedy's part of the plurality that saves it and basically saves the core holding of Roe v. Wade, and says abortion is still a constitutional right. And that is what gives us the undue burden test that is what the court has been using ever since. So Kennedy is seen as one of the votes that saved Roe.
Right.
That case now Roe has been around since 73. That case is a little sooner. So the conservatives had, at some point there's an argument about precedent of, cases that are books for 40 years or 50 years or something like that. And so it's a harder argument to make, but when it's a little fresher, it's easier to strike.
Well, and this comes to my final question for you, which is what happens next, and both in terms of who are the likely replacements that are going to be named and then how are they going to fare? But I know already coming out, is that with Kennedy gone, you can kiss, a lot of people on the liberal side or pro-choice side are saying, you can kiss Roe versus Wade goodbye within a year, or legalized abortion. What is your sense of who are the likely replacements, and how are the nomination hearings going to play out?
Well, Trump said it's going to be from the list of 25 that they had put forward. So assuming that that's true, and Trump has he's kept his word in terms of the list for Gorsuch. So we know the names. It's a combination of federal appellate judges and state Supreme Court justices on the list. It depends on the nominee, I guess, is the least satisfying but the most accurate way to say it.
We also have the precedent of Merrick Garland being kind of put on ice for a while, and that's a little bit different because the Republicans had control of the Senate. But I've already seen people saying, we got to push this back until at least after the November midterms and possibly into next year when the new however Congress changes will be seen. But so there's going to be a lot of there's going to be a lot of fireworks right coming up no matter what.
Oh, it's going to be. Yeah, it's going to be as ugly the rhetoric as you can imagine. The Republicans right now in the Senate have the votes to confirm a nominee, any nominee that they want. And so the real question is, can they do it? Can they get the whole machine, can keep all the troops in line and get it done before the midterms? Because in the midterms, the Senate could flip from RD, and then if that happens, then it's a replay of Merrick Garland.
Right.
The Kennedy seat will be held, vacant as long as the Democrats can hold it vacant. So, if they can, McConnell has said, we want to confirm this person before, in the fall, maybe hold hearings in September or something like that. So if they can move along quick enough and go through all of the process. Because you got to remember the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees is gone.
Right.
So if the Democrats, since they can't filibuster, there's a little parliamentary stalling tactics, but if the Republicans, you know, can be organized, they can do it. So it'll just be this sort of war of words, which are will there, be monumental, I suspect.
Are there any of the names on that list of 25 that you are saying, like, man, this person would be the joint? I want to see this person, you know, be the nominee.
Well, I would love to see Don Willett mm-hmm. on the Supreme Court. I think he would be a great pick. I think he deserves to be there. He was Texas Supreme Court Justice, and he's now on the Fifth Circuit. Was just confirmed, months ago. It's been, mm-hmm. Has issued a few opinions so far. And he was not only on the long list, but the pretty credible rumors were that he was on the shorter list of finalists, mm-hmm. maybe in the top five or something like that. So. You know, to me, he's a great pick. Diane Sykes.
What do you like about Willett?
I like that he cited my work in his rulings. I guess I have to say that at the outset. He's the most libertarian minded judge mm-hmm. in the country, federal judge in the country. Another in terms of libertarian minded people who's not on the list, but I think would be great to keep. Pushing up is Arizona Supreme Court Justice Clint Bolick, co-founder of Means to for Justice.
Yeah.
But in terms of the Trump list, Willett's a great name. And Willett's interesting because he unites the different factions of legal conservatism. I mean, he people on the if you're a true Borkian, you don't like him because he is disavowed the Borkian judicial deference model mm-hmm. very, very strongly. But yet legal conservatives still like him. Mm-hmm. So if it's him, it'll be interesting to see if there's any fractures in the Republican, kind of unified front. We saw just a hint of that during his confirmation hearings mm-hmm. in the Fifth Circuit when Senator Kennedy, Louisiana, asked him a couple questions that kind of got into this whole judicial activism business. Mm-hmm. It was the only substantive questions that Willett was asked, I should add. Democrats were talking about his tweets, and it was kind of a joke. It was the one Republican who maybe, got into some touchy stuff that maybe other conservatives might be like, oh, hey, maybe this is not the guy for us. So that's something that's interesting about him. And Willett, of course, has this record that is, he's taken positions that are contrary to those of the Trump administration,
right?
Which is kind of interesting, too. And to see that out of a nominee. So
you also mentioned, you mentioned Sykes as well.
Yeah, Judge Diane Sykes, federal appellate court judge out of Wisconsin. I think she would be a great addition to the Supreme Court, and she's on the long list. And then there's a number of names who are from my point of view would be not so great. And I've written about some of those for reasons. So we'll see sort of who gets it. It could be, in terms of an issue like the Fourth
Amendment. Are they only bad because they don't cite your work, Damon, or do you have like an actual argument against them?
That's the primary argument.
Sure.
The argument there is these are judges in the Bork mold.
Mm-hmm.
Who adopt this very defense, who like someone like Kevin Newsom, who has argued that basically that the slaughterhouse cases were correctly decided, which is that's getting into the legal kind of weeds a bit, but that's a pretty big that's a connected question. Did the Supreme Court get it right on the 14th Amendment and slaughterhouse or not? But that gets into the question of unenumerated rights and what does the privileges and immunities clause mean? And so Newsom has taken a position on that I think is wrong and is from an originalist point of view is wrong.
Would you say that what worries you the most over, and I realize, these guys who stay on the Supreme Court, they stay on for like 40, 50 years sometimes. So you never want to peg it to what's going on right now. But are you most worried about cases coming up that deal with things like the Fourth Amendment or, what is the thing that libertarians should be most worried about that the Supreme Court is going to be dealing with over the next couple of years?
A number of things. I mean, the criminal justice and Fourth Amendment related mm-hmm. issues. I mean, that's a good one to talk about because Kennedy was good and bad. You mm-hmm. can say on that, not so great on the Fourth Amendment always. And he was one of the dissenters in the Carpenter case that just came out mm-hmm. a week ago. So Kennedy and Neil Gorsuch, Gorsuch good on the Fourth Amendment in the way that Scalia was good on the Fourth Amendment. Kennedy maybe not so good, and so. Does the person who replaces Kennedy, is that a conservative who is sort of in a Gorsuch and Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts mold, who are pretty hawkish on the Fourth Amendment and are kind of in the camp with Justice Sotomayor? Or is it someone who is maybe much more pro-law enforcement on the Fourth Amendment and is closer to Alito? That's a really, really big issue going forward. The court's moving in a kind of aggressive pro-Fourth Amendment direction right now. That's a trend that, you know, could change. And so I think that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
All right. Well, we are going to leave it here. This has been the Reason Podcast. We've been talking with Damon Root of Reason. He's the author of Overruled, and he is the goddamn best Supreme Court watcher in this conversation and virtually any other conversation. Damon, thank you so much for talking.
Thanks, Nick. It's a pleasure.
This has been the podcast, The Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, or wherever you want to listen to us, and rate and review us while you are there. Thanks for listening.